Welcome to the reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, July 3rd. I'm your reader, Will Potter. Let's start off today with the article, A Day at the Park. Lost Island Theme Park Ready to Greet Crowds. Waterloo's latest attraction is up and running and ready to handle the crowds. Lost Island Theme Park, located on 159 acres at 2600 E. Shawless Road, opened in mid-June with a few hundred people coming through the gates on the first day. It was a planned soft opening to get staff up to speed, and also with new equipment we were going to have some hiccups here and there, said Gary Birch, a member of the family that operates the new theme park and its sister water park across the street. We've been in the low hundreds, and we're hoping to increase that. The rides are reliable. We are starting to push advertising now, he said. The park is home to an array of rides, ranging from a roller coaster so intense that it can suck the cell phone out of your shorts pocket, as it did for a courier reporter on a recent visit, to a slow and easy Ferris wheel with a fantastic view of the entire park. Playgrounds for smaller children and seating for their parents are also abundant. Visitors to the park are greeted with five colorful worlds to explore. Each land features its own characters, backstory, and patrons that can learn about from the educational art and artifacts, such as a Da Vinci-like flying machine, while they queue up for rides. Paths wind through Udara, the air element world that hosts the purple Nopuku air coaster, the Skyborne drop tower, and the Amara Aviator's flight ride. The water realm, Awa, includes an island on a 30-acre man-made lake that is home to the park's Ferris wheel. The centerpiece of the Fireland, Mura, is Volcanu, an interactive ride set inside a volcano. Tamariki, the spirit land, is geared for young children with a large playground and scaled-down versions of some of the other rides. The park's second roller coaster, the Green Matagani launch coaster and carousel, weren't open as of last week because of supply chain issues. Birch said that the rides should be ready to go later this year. Another attraction, the Utah Falls Flume Ride, won't be open this year because of a winter fire that damaged the control panel. It should be completed by opening day 2023, he said. Birch said Lost Island continues to accept applications for people looking to work at the theme park. The park is open daily during the summer until August 21st. After that, it will be open Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays in September, according to the park's online schedule. Tickets can be purchased online or at the gate and range from $45 to $49 depending on the day of the week. Parking is $10 per day and $15 for oversized vehicles. In addition to the theme park and Lost Island Water Park, the family also operates the Bamboo Ridge Campground, Monolo Adventure Golf, and Monolo Speedway Go-Karts Track, all located in the same area. Now, let's move on to a similar article. It says, Courier Reporters Sample the Rides. Courier staff members headed to Lost Island Theme Park's Media Day Tuesday to check out the rides at the newly opened attraction. Each reporter found that their sweet spot in one of the five themed worlds that make up the park. Following are impressions of what they experienced often while flying around through the air, shooting down a track, spinning or flipping, likely all accompanied by some screams. And here's a subheader that says, Vibrant Thrilling, and this is by Maria Cooper. Stepping into the theme park felt very welcoming, similar to how I'd feel walking into a bigger amusement park, like Disney World or Busch Gardens. The vibrancy of the park's surroundings and its soundtrack really reeled me in and continued to engage my senses throughout the visit. The kids section, Tamariki, is very inviting with playful colors and cute critters. The world is reminiscent of Candyland, but I think I'm just probably too old to be caught up in the Tamariki world. The color of the paths and the sound of music changed as I walked through the park. As shades shifted from pastels to wispy blues and purples, I found myself in Udara, the air realm. Udara definitely has the biggest, most thrilling rides of any section of the park. It contains rides like the Skyborne Drop Tower, the Purple Nōpuku Air Coaster, and Amara Aviators, my personal favorite. The roller coaster is definitely not for the first-time coaster riders. My feet dangled as I went upside down at least 5 times. The Lost Island website says 5, but it felt like a lot more to me. My favorite, the Aviator ride, put me in control. I sat in a chair and flapped the panels on either side of me. Once the chair got high enough, I could flap the wings in a correct rhythm and do as many barrel rolls as I liked. On the complete opposite end of the ride spectrum is Volcano, Quest for the Golden Idol. The track the ride follows took us through a cave to save the spirits of the theme park. We put on glasses that make the animated characters come to life. There were points on the ride where my car stopped and monsters kept coming at me. I had to shoot them with laser guns and we were equipped with. I didn't think this ride would be that interesting, but it ended up being one of my favorites. Apart from the rides, all of the staff guides seemed to really love what they did and made the visit much more special. Now on to another subsection, which is Cowardly Comfort by Andy Milone. Lost Island Theme Park offered the perfect amount of fun and thrill for me, as I think it would for others who describe themselves as scaredy cats but also have some thirst for adventure. I was delighted to discover Mura, the park's fire world, where a shaman's curse, Rokava, and Mura Fury stood ready to welcome my somewhat cowardly self. While on Shaman's Curse, I was one of dozen or so people sitting on the bicycle-like seats on a circular disc with the wheel that spun while traveling back and forth up two slopes over a central hump. The speed is not too quick. The ride kept me relatively close to the ground, and I enjoyed the view of the park. I was never worried once about falling off, and thus I had time to breathe, smile, and scream to the heavens. Rokava took it up a notch, but it wasn't too extreme. I was willing to give it a try. The most intimidating part about it was actually the big scary volcano monster in the backdrop. I took a seat in what looked like a stadium bleacher. Despite it being detached from the lava-loving creature, it felt like his arm had picked me and was moving me through the air rambunctiously like a child with a toy airplane. I felt higher up above the ground when I was riding Shaman's Curse and discovered along the way that this ride is not consistent in terms of its path through the air. It had lots of sudden twists and jerks as well as some flipping. Mura's Fury is a giant pendulum. I and others strapped into seats arranged in a circle rocked back and forth until we got higher and higher and eventually past the point of no return. In other words, we did a full 360 vertical flip and were upside down for a few seconds while spinning slowly horizontally. I'd say this ride was more therapeutic because I could enjoy being in motion. Similar to Shaman's Curse, it provided some predictability and kept me at ease. On to another subheader, Flights of Fancy by Donald Promnitz. The innovations of the people of Udara took them to the heavens. That was before the fall, though. Now Udarans are consigned to the ground in northeast Iowa. They haven't given up on their ambitions to get back into the air, and they're happy to use willing park-goers as test subjects on their newest experiments. That included me. The rides in the air-themed Udara section include Nōpuku Air Coaster, the Dream Spinner, the Skyborne Drop Tower, and Amara Aviators. As a kid who grew up in California with some of the best roller coasters in America, and as someone with a lifelong love of aviation, I was more than satisfied. Skyborne took me and other riders 185 feet into the air before a sudden drop back down to the earth. Then came the Nōpuku Air Coaster, which hurled me through the air while safely strapped into my seat and still allowed for plenty of flips and twists. Finally, there's the Amara Aviators, a set of 12 individual winged pods with controls on the wings. Pushing them up and down, I had control over my seat to spin and roll at my leisure. It took a couple of tries, but once mastered, it became my personal favorite. All in all, if you like rides and love flight, don't skip out on your chance to be an Udaran test pilot. And that does it for that article. Now we can move on to a different article, and that is study finds inconclusive evidence of price gouging in fertilizer market. A sharp rise in fertilizer prices over the past 2 years doesn't appear to have one single cause, according to a new report from Iowa State University economists. The report was requested by the Iowa Attorney General's office to examine the possibility of market manipulation in fertilizer costs. It analyzed year-over-year fertilizer prices compared to other goods such as crops, natural gas, and farm equipment. Researchers noted that COVID-19, supply chain problems, and international conflicts and natural disasters have all contributed to the rising cost of fertilizer. The study wasn't able to conclude that greedflation, or companies taking advantage of inflation to artificially hike prices, is happening in the fertilizer market, and the researchers said that they needed more information before making a determination. The punchline of this report is that it's not one thing, it's a whole fleet of reasons, and that's why we saw the high fertilizer prices that we did, said Chad E. Hart, an Iowa State economics professor who worked on the study. The researchers also noted that they expect to see fertilizer prices fall over the rest of 2022 as some of the strains on the market ease. Fertilizer prices are between 2 and 4 times higher than they were in the fall of 2020, while crop prices roughly doubled in the same period, prompting Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller to request a study to determine if manufacturers were taking advantage of inflation and high farm incomes. This thorough report raises many good questions, which we will continue to explore, Miller, a Democrat, said in a press release after the report was released. Although there are a lot of unknowns, we remain concerned that increases in crop returns for farmers tend to coincide with even higher increases in fertilizer expenditures. The office will continue researching fertilizer prices and talking to farmers about their concerns, Miller's Chief of Staff Lynn Hicks said. These concerns have also reached the national level. In April, Iowa's three Republican House representatives signed on to a letter with dozens of House Republicans urging President Joe Biden to take an executive action to address the cost of fertilizer and ease farmers' financial burdens stemming from the fertilizer costs. The letter suggested prioritizing fertilizer minerals like phosphate and potash, and increasing natural gas production and exports, among other measures. Iowa representatives also signed onto a March letter urging the U.S. International Trade Commission to remove tariffs on fertilizer from Morocco, which they said were driving prices up for farmers. One major cause of the recent rise in fertilizer prices was the increase in natural gas costs between 2021 and 2022, the ISU report found. The price of natural gas, a vital component in most fertilizers, rose quickly in late 2021 because of low supply and high demand, the report said. This is in turn caused some fertilizer producers to reduce production, driving up prices. Sanctions and international pressures on China and Russia also affected the global market. Because of the bevy of pressures on the market, Hart said, researchers weren't able to conclude that price gouging was happening, and more information would be needed to be sure. Now let's move on to a subheader, Farmers Squeezed. Farmers are concerned about the high cost of fertilizer following the spring planting season. While high crop prices have been able to keep net farm income high, Iowa Farm President Brent Johnson said if fertilizer prices don't come down, many farmers won't be able to break even. If the commodity market continues to erode, the economics that farmers are going to experience is gonna go red, and it could go red significantly if the grain markets fall, he said. Johnson, who farms in Calhoun County, said his dry fertilizer cost doubled and his nitrogen cost tripled between 2021 and 2022. While the ISU study suggested that prices could go down this year, that prediction is dependent on the price of natural gas dropping as well, Hart said. Johnson said he wasn't confident that farmers would see fertilizer costs drop. Lance Lillibridge, president of the Iowa Corn Growers Association, said that the results of the study were disappointing but expected. He said that he's still concerned about the possible of unfair market pressures around fertilizer. When companies get monopolistic, in other words, when they start controlling 70 and 80% of a particular product, that's problematic because it doesn't allow competition, he said. The uncertainty in the market leaves farmers guessing as they plan for 2023. Lillibridge said that farmers were unable to get fall and spring delivery prices for fertilizers, making it difficult to plan crop productions for future seasons. Both Johnson and Lillibridge said that if costs remain high next year, farmers might plant fewer crops to save on fertilizer costs, which could pose challenges on the national food supply. All we can do is have different scenarios. If it's X, I do this. If it's Y, I do this, Lillibridge said. There's not a whole lot of planning going on. Now let's move on to another article. Hinson and Mathis, don't cancel student loans. U.S. House Democrats last week unanimously blocked a measure that would have stopped President Joe Biden from canceling hundreds of billions of dollars in student loan debt. The amendment, introduced by Iowa Republican U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson, would have prohibited the Biden administration from moving forward with its student loan debt cancellation plan. Hinson offered the amendment during a House Appropriations Committee markup of fiscal year 2023 Labor, Health, and Human Services and Education Bill. Student loan debt cannot be canceled. It can only be transferred onto the backs of hardworking Iowans and Americans, Hinson said during her weekly call with Iowa reporters Friday. This will be paid for by those who choose not to go to college or those who worked hard to pay back their loans and already did not and loans already and did not have debt. It's simply not fair to be asking truck drivers, linemen, bartenders, electricians, and plumbers to pay for someone else's degree. Biden has said that he intends to take a hard look at student loan forgiveness. As a candidate, Biden expressed an interest in canceling at least $10,000 in student debt per person. To date, he's repeatedly extended a pause on requiring borrowers to repay their loans. A moratorium that was put into place under the then-President Donald Trump near the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. Hinson and her Democratic opponent in the fall election, State Senator Liz Mathis of Hiawatha, find rare common ground on the issue. I had student loans and so did my kids, Mathis said in a statement. The cost of higher education is way too high, and we must do more to train people for the good-paying jobs we need to fill here in Iowa. I have worked in the state Senate to bring down the cost of college and increase the access to skills training. This proposal from Biden's administration solves neither problem. More blind spending is not a solution. And here's a subheader that says the numbers. Student loans are now the second largest slice of household debt after mortgages, outpacing credit card debt. More than 43 million Americans hold an excess of $1.7 trillion in outstanding debt. That's nearly double the $828 billion held a decade ago, according to the Peter G. Peterson Foundation, a nonpartisan organization addressing America's long-term fiscal challenges. Americans owe a greater average amount of student debt than any other time in U.S. history. About 20% of households own an average of $42,000 in student debt in 2019, according to the foundation. But by comparison, 8% of U.S. households held student debt 30 years before the average amount was $11,500 after adjusting for inflation. Supporters argue forgiving student debt would free up younger generations to invest in their financial future, provided a moderate boost to the economy, and help address racial and socioeconomic inequality. Borrowers of color are more likely to hold student debt, owe more on average, and often experience more difficulty repaying their loans than white borrowers, according to a study by the National Center for Education Statistics. Opponents contend that the costs of such forgiveness would be much higher than the benefit to the economy, would disproportionately benefit higher-income Americans, and fail to address the root cause of rising tuition costs that spurred more borrowing. Hinson said that widespread debt forgiveness would not be equitable, as student debt is mostly owed by middle and higher-income borrowers. According to J.P. Morgan Chase & Co., under the universal $10,000 cancellation, 12% of forgiven debt would go to the lowest 20% of earners, while 23% would go to the highest 20% of earners. The White House has suggested that there would be some kind of income criteria that would prevent high earners from benefiting. Another subheader, Ultimate Problem. Hinson, who received a bachelor's degree in broadcast journalism from the University of Southern California, said that she was fortunate her parents put away money for years so I could go to school and graduate debt-free. We need to be addressing the ultimate problem here, which is the cost of education and access to training programs, Hinson said. The Marion Republican also said that colleges and universities need to be empowering students to become smarter borrowers, improving Iowa loan counseling services with information comparing their likely monthly income after expenses with their likely student loan payment so that they can make smart decisions on the front end. There are a lot of ways that we can address the ultimate root cause here, which is the rising cost of education, Hinson said. But I don't think that shifting the burden to taxpayers is fair at all. Now let's move to the article. Corn lucky to be knee-high by the 4th of July, but experts see potential for a good crop. Most years, Iowa corn is far taller than knee-high by 4th of July, but this year's crop, set back by a late planting and too little rain, fits the adage. This year, it's more of an appropriate saying, said Mark Licht, an assistant professor and cropping systems and specialist with Iowa State University Extension and Outreach. I was just in a couple of cornfields that were at knee height. A couple of other fields I've been driving past, I question whether they were even at that level. The knee-high phrase may be as old as Iowa, founded in 1846. One of the earliest time the phrases appeared on an Eastern Iowa newspaper was on July 3, 1884, when the Sumner Gazette said, it has been considered that if the corn was knee-high by the 4th of July, that the crop would be sure and safe, the Gazette Time Machine reported last year. But with advanced corn breeding and fertilizer, corn today often reaches 8 feet by midsummer. That's under good growing conditions, the Iowa Corn Growers Association reported. Iowa's cold and wet spring delayed the corn planting statewide by 2 weeks. And set soybean planting back 12 days, the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship reported in May. That wait contributed to 4% fewer corn acres planted across nationwide this year, according to the numbers released Thursday by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Agriculture Statistics Service. The service estimates that nearly 90 million acres of corn were planted nationwide this spring, down 4% from 2021. Farmers planted 88.3 million acres of soybeans, up 1% from last year. The data comes from surveys of 9,100 segments of land and more than 64,000 farm operators during the first 2 weeks of June. Part of this issue with corn growth is areas where we had too much water, so we had some saturated soil that slowed things down a little bit, Licht said. In areas of the state that are really dry, that is holding back some of that height as well. He said that the corn and soybean plants are not elongating as much as they normally would by early July, which is typical of hotter, drier conditions. About half of Iowa's 99 counties are abnormally dry or worse, with two of western Iowa counties, Plymouth and Woodbury, considered an extreme drought, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor's June 30th report. But there's still plenty of potential for Iowa's 2022 corn crop. Other than the northwest quarter of the state, really the rest of the state has some pretty great soil moisture, Licht said. I've had about 12 inches of rain in June at my house. That's a lot more than normal. Hopefully we keep getting the occasional downpours. In Iowa, the nation's number one corn-producing state, corn acres are down about 2%, Licht said. He sees the late planting season as less of a factor in declining corn across acres in Iowa than the price of fertilizer. The U.S. is importing less nitrogen fertilizer from Russia because of sanctions imposed after Russia's attack on Ukraine. Supply chain issues and COVID-19 also have slowed down fertilizer production, contributing to prices 2 to 4 times higher than they were in September 2020, the ISU reported in June. While the selling price of corn has also increased, some farmers may have decided to switch some corn acres to soybeans, Licht said. Now let's move on to North End Arts and Music Festival features Summer Soul Parade Entertainment. The North End Cultural Center will kick off the annual North End Arts and Music Fest on Friday Lou in partnership with Main Street Waterloo. Flava, a local R&B, blues, pop, and rock band, will perform during the Friday event. Members are Gary Keys, Eddie Jones, Randy Creighton, David Palmer, Ron Nesby, Aaron Nesby, Lisa Davenport, and Sherman Flowers. Burlington's DJ Ant Bomb will get the party started in Lincoln Park beginning at 5 p.m. We wanted to bring some of that North End flavor to downtown Waterloo and to showcase our community's artistry and creativity, said Felicia Smith-Knowles, Artistic Director for the North End Cultural Center. DJ Ant Bomb is a party DJ, so he's going to give us that family reunion barbecue vibe to get the weekend started. Food vendors will include Jim's Barbecue, Barbecue Brazil, Hungry Charlie's, Konami Ice, Two Away, and Dominique Seafood. There will also be arts and crafts vendors and creative spaces throughout Lincoln Park. Competition drill teams from across the country will be featured at the Summer Soul Parade, starting at 10 a.m. Saturday. The drill teams will be in Waterloo for the Marching Against the Darkness competition at Young Arena, starting at 6 p.m. Saturday. Details are online at matd.org. The parade begins at Gates Park, following a route from Lynn to North Barclay Streets, then north to Newell Streets and Newell to Mobile Streets, and ending at Ferguson Fields Park. Awards will be presented to winning entries. I love that the parade goes through Waterloo streets that sometimes have been historically neglected. Now we're showing people what the North End is about and inviting them to experience it. It's exciting, and the drill teams are always so high energy and talented, Smith-Knowles said. Festivities continue to the park from noon to 5:30 p.m. Saturday. The Gallagher Blue Dorm Performing Arts Center is bringing a free community block party to the festival. GBPAC has provided the stage, sound, and lights and crew. That has really helped us and expand our live entertainment. It's a great partnership and support for the community, she explained. Entertainment will include performances by low-key and R&B souls and funk band, Sam Mack Jr. and Stankface, hip-hop, literacy, Lollipop, and Ahmed Madlock. Local food and merchandise vendors will be on the grounds, and community nonprofit organizations will offer information on local resources. North End artists will showcase their work, and a series of Artwell panels will be displayed throughout the park. In addition, the youth art team will return this year to create portraits of festival goers. There are no vendor fees to participate in the festival in order to encourage participation, Smith-Knowles said. People create art or make things and want to show it and sell it, but they aren't sure how to do that, or they don't have enough time, or they don't have enough of it in store or open a store. This is that time and place that they have a voice. She added that this is a neighborhood event, and giving voice to this community is the most important thing. Art is the expression of self, and we're bringing people together not just to showcase their work, but to let the public come and experience that vibe of creativity, the vibe of North End. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, July 3rd on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Deborah K. Pflasgraf. Deborah K. Pflasgraf of 62 of Waterloo died Wednesday, June 29th, 2022 at Northcrest Specialty Care in Waterloo. She was born January 20th, 1960 in Waterloo, daughter of Delmer and Joyce Bachman Stickfort. Deb graduated from Waterloo East High School with class of 1978. She graduated from the University of Northern Iowa with her bachelor's in education and later earning her master's from Viterbo University. Deb married Mark Pflasgraf in 1993 and they later divorced. Deb was a technology and business teacher at Waterloo East High School for 34 years until she retired in 2018. She was a member of the Waterloo Gospel Hall. Deb trusted in Christ as her personal savior on August 19, 1974. Deb enjoyed spending her time taking weekend trips with her family. She also enjoyed gardening, cooking, and listening to podcasts. Deb is survived by her daughter Kimberly Hunemiller of Cedar Falls, son Michael Pflasgraf of Evansdale, her parents Delmer Stickfort of Raymond, and sister Susan Stickfort of Waterloo. Memorial services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, June 6, 2022, at Bethany Bible Chapel, 4507 Round Street, Cedar Falls. Visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. Tuesday, July 5th at Bethany Bible Chapel. Interment will take place at the Garden of Memory Cemetery in Waterloo. Memorials may be directed to Care Initiatives Hospice. Condolences may be left at www.lockfuneralservices.com. Lock at Tower Park, 4140 Kimball Avenue, Waterloo is assisting the family. Marilyn J. Nesvik. Marilyn J. Nesvik, 88, of Cedar Falls, died Sunday, May 22, 2022, at Northcrest Specialty Care. Marilyn was born May 13, 1934, in El Dorado, Iowa, the only daughter of Arthur and Ruth Trapp. She married Alan Nesvik of West Union on March 6, 1954, at St. Peter Lutheran Church in El Dorado. Marilyn graduated from West Union High School. She worked several jobs, including a stint at the Pentagon, before she moved on to become a homemaker, raising two sons. After Alan died, Marilyn took her passion for reading books and volunteered at the Book Nook. Her hard work earned a promotion to the director of the Book Nook and later a board member of the Cedar Falls Library. She spent over 25 years devoted to the Book Nook, not only in its current location, but also in the original CFPL basement. Marilyn gathered, organized, scheduled, priced, recommended, sold, and had a steadfast dedication to the Nook's success. She worked as many hours as some library employees and set a great example for her team members. Marilyn is survived by sons Steve Nesvik of Santan Valley, Arizona, and Mike Nesvik of Cedar Falls, and three grandchildren, Katie Cornelius of Chandler, Arizona, Zach Nesvik of Phoenix, Arizona, Caroline Nesvik of Des Moines, Iowa, and many nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her husband, Alan, and her parents and two brothers, R. Ken Trapp and Chaplain Colonel Richard D. Trapp. No funeral services will be held. A celebration of life will be held on July 10th from 2 to 5 p.m. at the Cedar Falls Community Center. Memorials in Marilyn's honor can be made to the Friends of the Family or the American Cancer Society. Richard George Seehusen. Richard George Seehusen, 91, of Allison, passed away Saturday, June 25th, 2022 at the Waverly Health Center. Visitation was held from 5 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, June 28th at the Council Woodley Funeral Home in Allison. Funeral services were held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, June 29th, 2022 at the St. James Lutheran Church in Allison. The Council Woodley Funeral Home of Allison cared for Richard and his family. Richard was born March 29th, 1931 on a farm south of Allison, the son of George and Marie Seehusen. He was united in marriage to Rose Eulenhop on February 26, 1950. He attended country school and received his GED diploma at Allison High School. He and Rose were lifelong members of the St. James Lutheran Church in Allison. Richard worked for several farmers in his early years. Following their marriage, Richard and Rose moved north of Allison and northeast of Maynard. Over the years, he worked at Farmers Implement in Allison, John Trey's Filling Station, and for the USDA. Richard also worked for the Iowa Highway Department of Transportation in Black Hawk and Butler counties as a secondary road maintainer, operator, and mechanic for almost 30 years. After Richard's retirement in 1992, he and Rose delivered motorhomes throughout the U.S. and Canada for over 12 years. Richard loved spending time with his grandchildren and great-granddaughter and attended many of their activities. He enjoyed fishing, boating, and liked puttering with engines and helping his son with demo cars. Richard is survived by his son, Russell Seehusen, and grandchildren Mitchell and Nathan Seehusen, Hannah and Connor Ferks, daughter Rhonda Edgar, and grandchildren Cheer Monica and Jason Edgar, and great-granddaughter Emily Edgar, and many nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his wife Rose, parents, four sisters, two brothers, and granddaughters-in-law, Whitney Seehusen. Harold Sorensen. Harold Sorensen, 67, of Cedar Falls, passed away unexpectedly on Wednesday, June 29th, 2022. He was born April 15th, 1955, to Edwin and Belua Sorensen. Harold married Julie Ann Witt on June 30th, 1990. He was a proud farmer, having planted the beloved home farm for the 53rd season this year. He is survived by his wife, four children, two grandchildren, brothers, and three sisters. His funeral service will be at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, July 7th, 2022, at Zion Lutheran Church of Hudson, with visitation from 4 to 7 p.m. the evening before at Dahl Van Hove Schoof Funeral Home in Cedar Falls. Full obituary information at www.dahlfuneralhome.com. Now, let's move over to the sports section, starting with Sumner Fredericksburg Morgan Brandt carried on the family tradition. Ask any coach at Sumner Fredericksburg High School about Morgan Brandt. That coach might not talk about how great of an athlete she has been for the Cougars. They will talk about the girl who constantly giggles and always has a smile on her face. They will talk about the leader who is the first at practice and the last to leave. She loves life, former Sumner Fredericksburg volleyball coach Tori Sorensen said. She is one of those kids that is always smiling. It's a rarity to see her frustrated or upset. Morgan just enjoys life. I don't think you will find a better person than Morgan, added Kevin Bergman, who has the honor of coaching her in both basketball and softball. Eventually, each coach will get around to Brandt the athlete, and she is a darn good one. The list of her accomplishments in the 4 years at Sumner Fredericksburg is impressive. Elite All-State in volleyball, an All-State basketball player who scored more than 1,000 points in her career. She was the number two player on the Cougars Class 2A State Championship golf team this spring. And to cap it all off, Brandt has been a four-year starter on the softball team, where, you guessed it, she earned All-State honors. For those reasons, the future Iowa State volleyball player has been named the 2022 Courier Female Athlete of the Year. Brandt was chosen by a group of area sports and media from impressive list of six finalists, including Annika Behrens of Waverly Shellrock, Reese Johnson of Denver, Amanda Teptrow of Denver, Sophia Hoffman of Dyke, New Hartford, and Grace Fredericks of Cedar Falls. "I haven't thought anything of it," said Brandt when asked if it will be weird when her prep athletic career finishes later this month at the conclusion of the softball season. "It's never been which sport I'm playing. I'm just out there having fun with my friends. I don't think of the accolades that come along with it. They are just there. It's more of the memories I made and having my friends around. I couldn't imagine what it would be like not to going to the gym after school with my friends. That will be weird not to have anymore. Without athletics, none of those memories would have been created. And then what would life have been like? It would have been boring. So thank you to all my teammates, coaches, for all the..." If I can find the next page. "So thanks to my teammates and coaches for all the memories you have given me, the opportunities you have presented to me. But as gracious as Brandt is, both Sorensen and Bergman say don't be fooled by the smiley persona she presents. She likes to have fun, but is serious about what she is doing," Bergman said. "She is going to do all the little things right. I've never coached another athlete that had a motor like hers," Sorensen added. "She goes 100% all the time, every time. She might be the most competitive athlete I've coached. She can't stand to lose, but at the same time, she's able to handle the loss, look at the positives, and figure out a way to get a better outcome the next time out. And she draws that out of her teammates, too." Volleyball and Iowa State are two primary loves for Brandt, who grew up in a volleyball family. She is the third Brandt girl to serve as setter for the Cougars. In fact, a Brandt has been Summer Fredericksburg setter all but 1 year since 2009. Kaylin, 8 years older, went on to play at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, where she ranks third all-time in assists with more than 3,000. Jenna, 4 years older, played at both Iowa State and Northern Iowa, where she racked up more than 1,000 assists. Morgan grew up setting volleyballs back and forth with her older sisters and traveling many miles to club tournaments throughout the Midwest. While close to all of her siblings, including older brother Isaiah, Morgan, the youngest, most wanted to grow up like Jenna, although both her sisters have influenced her. "Growing up, I always had a ball in my hand, lived in the gym," Morgan said. "I saw them be role models to other kids, how everybody looked up to them, and I thought that was so cool. So when I was that player, I knew I wanted to be like them. They were the ones who gave me the drive. They were the ones who started it all. But I did grow up wanting to be just like Jenna," continued Morgan. "She tore her ACL this December, and now she is running miles, running half marathons. She has always had the ambition to be the best. I feel that is why I wanted to be just like her. I wanted to work just as hard as her." There is one other thing that Morgan does hold over Jenna. She is 3 inches taller. "Yeah, she doesn't like to talk about it," laughed Morgan. Brandt stepped on into Sorensen's lineup as freshman's starting setter. But over the years, her role evolved out of necessity into the playing one of the pin post positions for the Cougars. At 6 feet tall, Brandt had a powerful swing once she was trained up a bit. "Because I came from a family of setters, no one had trained me to hit," Brandt said. "We kind of started working with her as a sophomore, the basics, but it wasn't until she was a junior that we really started to break down her approach and swing," Sorensen said. "Not a lot of kids could step into that role and play at the level she did, but she embraced the challenge and loved it." Over her final 3 seasons, Brandt was part of a 5-2 offense as she finished with more than 1,600 career assists and nearly 900 kills. Although primarily a setter for the six-pack club team that included Avery Beckett of Waverly Shellrock, Olivia Bronner of Cedar Falls, Lydia Imbrongo of Wapsie Valley, and Cassidy Mowinkle of Appleton's Parkerburg, Brandt spent some time at pin position this past club season. Major colleges were in on Brant early, but her love of Iowa State University made her choice easy. Brant committed to the Cyclones her freshman season at Sumner Fredericksburg. She never wavered from that decision, Sorensen said. I've always wanted to go to Iowa State for as long as I can remember, Morgan said. I remember pushing Jenna to go to Iowa State during her recruiting process. I like the campus, I like the coaching staff, and the girls on the team. While volleyball is the sport Brant is most known for, Bergman says that she has other options that she has chosen to pursue them. That I think she could have went Division One in every sport she participated in, Bergman said. As a post player, Brant averaged 21.1 points a game during a winning basketball season. She led the Cougar softball squad in RBIs a year ago with 43 in a season. She batted a 441 with 23 extra base hits in a 102 at bats. Bergman says Brant, who has leads S through F with 30 RBIs this season, is a dangerous hitter every time she steps into the box. With the success of the golf team, she didn't practice with us, so her hitting hasn't been as good as it was last year. But she is still a threat every time she takes a swing, Bergman said. Golf. That is an interesting story. Brant ran track as a freshman, but COVID wiped out her sophomore season. With nothing to do and the Meadowbrook County Club with a mile from her house, Brant went to the golf course and began hitting balls. I never expected to join the team, but I picked it up pretty easy, said Brant, who shot an 85 during the state tournament at Pheasant Ridge last month. I met this guy at the course. He just turned 84. Ron Kuth is his name. He taught me everything. With her softball season winding down, Brant is excited for her future. She has been taking a class in Ames once a week and says that she will move there as soon as softball season is over. And that brings Brant to reminiscing about Sumner and trips to JC Grocery. I'm excited to venture out to a bigger city to go to college, Brant said. It will be different. I'm from a tight-knit school community, but I remember at orientation at Iowa State, I realized people don't know me here. In Sumner, you can walk into a grocery store and people know you. You walk anywhere in town and everybody knows you. So it's going to be weird to not know anybody, like look into the crowd and say, "Where are my people?" However, it feels as soon as the smiley, energetic, full of life, driven to succeed Brant unleashes her persona in Ames, she won't be able to walk unrecognized for long. Now let's move on to the corresponding article to that one, which is Brother Leader Teammate, Cedar Falls' Trey Campbell is the whole package. Since his earliest days, Trey Campbell said that he remembers being around sports and using them as an outlet for that insatiable energy that makes children unable to sit still. I have always been a kid that always wants to do something, Campbell said. I could not sit still, so when I got older, sports was the answer. Doing all of them throughout the year became the normal. The perfect outlet for his energy quickly turned into a passion for football and track and field. However, like his two primary sporting idols, his brother and LeBron James, Campbell loved basketball and dreamed of playing in the NBA. It is just the dream, Campbell said. I feel like that is where all basketball players nowadays want to get to. That is the tower where they want to be. I feel like that is where I want to be too. According to Campbell, the easiest way to make this dream a reality was to earn a spot playing in basketball for a Division I school, no small feat on its own. A truth Campbell saw early on in his career. My brother, he was also a basketball player, Campbell said, in Michigan. He was Mr. Basketball, so he was pretty good. He had aspirations to do big things, but he really did not have the grades. A talented player in his own right, Campbell's older brother, D. Roberts, received Division I interest out of high school, but academics forced him to play junior college basketball instead. According to Roberts, poor academics continued to plague him in JUCO and prevented him from making the jump to Division I. This experience allowed Roberts to push his younger brother to greater than himself. I knew that he wanted to be like me, Robert said. After high school, I recognized my faults. So I always told him, keep your nose clean because your past will always catch up to you. I think that he really took that in for consideration. With a 9-year age gap between the two, Robert said that he felt paternal in his effort to help his brother accomplish the goals which they both held. My brother was like my first son, Robert said, so I always pushed myself to the highest heights so I could show him the way and get him further than I went. That was always the goal. And he always listened. He always pushed himself. Robert started by having Campbell join him as a workout. Started by having him join him by a workout and training partner. But despite the age gap, Roberts did not go easy on Campbell. He was not going easy, Campbell said. He was not being nice. He was not doing all that. However, according to Roberts, Campbell did not struggle keeping up with his high school or college level workouts. I have always trained him on higher level workouts, Robert said. When I was in high school and college, he was 9 or 10 years old. I am making him do the things that I was working on. He has always been advanced. It was not really hard for him. I would show him once or twice and he would get it down. Through these workouts, which continued after the brothers no longer lived in the same city, Roberts said that he saw Campbell develop into a formidable basketball talent. Now that he has just mastered it, Roberts said, he has put in his 10,000 hours. Now it is just clockwork to him. It is easy to make it is near flawless. Roberts continued that he only recently realized just how skillful his younger brother became through their shared work. Just the other day, he sent me a video of him throwing an alley-oop to himself and putting it between his legs, Roberts said. He missed twice, but just the simple fact of him doing that his freshman year of college, I was not doing that. I cannot even put it between my legs. I can jump pretty high, but I cannot do any of that. He got me for sure. Roberts, who recently signed to play professional basketball in Mexico, continue that he believes that Campbell surpassed him even his own athletic ability and has a chance at NBA dreams. Athletically, he is 10 times better than me, Roberts said. I do not admit that to him. I see him in the NBA someday. I really do. I think that he can pursue that. I think not just athletically, but mentally, he gets it to be able to reach that type of level. He is a smart kid. I think that he can go far in his life with his athleticism and his mentality. This athletic prowess is evident to not only Campbell's older brother. Look across the recent history of Cedar Falls football, boys basketball, and track and field. The impact which Trey Campbell on each Tigers program cannot be missed. From individual feats to team success, Campbell played a role in countless Tiger wins and led by example throughout. According to Cedar Falls head track and field coach Dirk Homewood, Campbell left an unmistakable mark on his teammates, coaches, and record books during his 3 years as a member of the Cedar Falls track and field program. Trey Campbell is a fantastic athlete, very gifted in a lot of different ways, Homewood said. I think that the thing that he brings is leadership by example. Anything that he tends to do, he does with a high level of excitement. He brings that excitement to the practice. To practice, he brings it to his teammates and definitely shows his performances. Homewood continued highlighting the historical implications of Campbell's career on the Oval. He has a couple of state titles to his name, Homewood said. The biggest one, the long jump, record has stood since 1978. The jump that he jumped at district championship is probably a record that will last as long as the previous one, 24 feet 5 inches. That is the top five all-time Iowa best performance. His name will get associated with long jump for a long period of time, but when you look at a state championship in the distance medley, multiple runner-up position on several other relays, his name will be in the record book for a long, long time. According to Homewood, Campbell's impact on the Tigers track and field program will not end following his graduation. "He is a passionate person, competitive person," Homewood said. "The biggest message that we can send out and use Trey as an example is that multiple sports make you that much better. He realized that by running track, that he was developing his quickness for the football field and the basketball court. That is a really important message to send out." For Cedar Falls head boys basketball coach Ryan Schultz, "The most important aspect of Trey Campbell, the athlete, is Trey Campbell, the person. He's not just an exceptional person, a great teammate and a great leader," Schultz said. "That lends itself to what he did on the basketball floor over 3 years. So you start with that, the person and the leader." Schultz pointed to Campbell's care for his teammates and his leadership as signs of what made him successful athletically at Cedar Falls High School. "He cares about his teammates," Schultz said. "He wants them to do well. He picks them up when they are down. He understands when he needs to put his team on his back. He takes that on without hesitation. He does it in multiple ways, but mostly it is taking on that responsibility and wanting the best for others." As a leader, Schultz saw teammates naturally look up to Campbell's calm way of setting the right example. "They looked to him," Schultz said. "It is one thing to have the ability, but they saw how he approached the game and how he approached practice, how he treated others, how serious he took it and what it meant to him. I think all those things lend itself to others wanting to follow that. He did it in a very natural, positive way." While he emphasized Campbell the person, Schultz also spoke highly of Campbell the basketball player. "He is just exceptional at all aspects," Schultz said. "His quickness, his vision, his ability to score in different ways, ability to affect the game in multiple different ways, whether it's passing, defense, rebounding, scoring. He led us in multiple different categories. He is just a tremendous all-around athlete." As Campbell moved on to play for Northern Iowa men's basketball team, Schultz said that it will be difficult to replace the person who led the Tigers to 3 straight state tournaments, set a new school record for career assists, and became one of the best players that has ever come through Cedar Falls. "He is leaving a huge mark," Schultz said. "He is going to be a tough guy to replace in so many ways. He has a great personality. He's such a smart kid. He has a great sense of humor. I cannot say enough about him as a person, and him as a leader, and him as an athlete. I just think that he is the whole package." And that does it for today's reading of The Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, July 3rd. I'm your reader, Will Potter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.